Welcome to our series of classes, Kabbalah on Relationships. And as a famous rabbi once said, before I'll begin speaking, I want to say a few words. So before I'll begin speaking, I want to say a few words, and a few words will be that whenever people speak about relationships in America and in the Western world, people usually automatically assume that we are going to be talking about marital relationships. We are going to be talking about relationships between husband and wife. We are going to be talking about relationships with your spouse. Well, today's class will be in part about relationship with your spouse, but not only, and by far not only. I am assuming just because the Western world puts so much emphasis on love and relationships between men and women that whenever you think about this topic, you think about two spouses. The Torah emphasizes that there are different types of relationships and they are all important and they're all very different. You love your spouse and you love your children and you love your parents. These are all very powerful feelings, but Kabbalah explains how these types of love are different. And by the way, that's why they cannot be mixed. And according to Kabbalah, this is why you should not be marrying your relatives, your close relatives. Just like love between a brother and a sister is different than love between husband and wife, and so on and so forth. So we are going to be talking about all kinds of relationships, relationships with your family members, relationships with your friends, with your co-workers, with your neighbors, with your not such a good friends, with your not such a good relatives. There was a book written, I never read the book, but I love the title, Why Do Bad Relatives Happen to Good People? And if you have those relatives, we're going to be speaking about them as well. And with this, we will begin. And we will begin from the beginning. There was a patient that once came to a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist asks him, could you please share your story? The patient says, where should I start from? The doctor says, well, start from the beginning. The patient says, okay, in the beginning, I created the heavens and the earth. So we're going to start from the very beginning. And in the very, very beginning, right after, not me, but God created heavens and earth, God also created Adam, Adam HaRishon. And, interestingly enough, Adam was the only creature that was brought about in a singular form. God created many fish. God created many elephants, many snakes, many mosquitoes. I think too many, as a matter of fact. But when it came to a human, God created only one. Why is that? It's a whole topic on its own. And one of the reasons Talmud tells us this is because we want to emphasize that one human life is like the whole world. And that's why somebody who saves one human life, like he saves the whole mankind. But then after God created one human, Adam, he said it is not good for a person to be alone, and that's why he split him into two. He split the Adam. By the way, don't believe atoms. You know why? They make up everything. So God split Adam, and the statement that God made has two parts. Number one, he says, it's not good for a human to be alone. Then God says, let me split him into two and have a man and a woman. But the first half, our sages tell us, is a statement of its own. It's not good for a human to be alone. We humans are not meant to be alone. We are social creatures. We are always connected with our surroundings, and we are always dependent on our surroundings. I know you could read stories about Robinson Crusoe, sounds very exciting, but in reality, people don't survive very well if they are lonely. very often people think that, well, if somebody is an extrovert, he needs social circles. But if somebody is introvert, he's okay to be himself alone. It's not true. A person might need a smaller social circle. A person might need his interactions with others not as often, but everybody needs them. And this is one of the reasons why in Judaism we put so much emphasis on a community. If somebody wants to be an observant Jew and he'll be living somewhere in the middle of Montana mountains under big blue sky, well, first of all, there are many mitzvot, there are many commandments he simply won't be able to do. But then besides for that, he will be missing out on a large aspect of Jewish life, which is communal life. This is why, by the way, Baltimore, where we live, has a large Jewish community, has a very established Jewish community, and I see people all the time who are moving here from other smaller places. Very often, people, when they live in some remote location, they become more observant, more involved in Jewish life, and then they want to move out from Montana or Iowa City or Idaho or wherever else they live over there, because they want to move to a Jewish community. And this is why there's so much in the Torah that focuses on interpersonal relationships. And there's an interesting statement in the Torah. It says everybody should have a rabbi. Everybody has to have a person who they'll turn to. Interestingly enough, it doesn't necessarily mean a rabbi per se. It's meant a mentor. Everybody should have a mentor, somebody who you'll turn to with your life's questions. And this is very important. And every mentor needs to have a mentor also. And the Rebbe was often saying that people want to find somebody to be their mentor who will be some distinguished holy person. And the Rebbe said, if you have somebody who is a distinguished holy person who is your mentor, that's great, but it's not absolutely necessary. The Rebbe was saying the very fact that you will have somebody who is not you, who you will have a chance to bounce your ideas off of, is good by itself, because you are biased about your own issues and about your own questions. Somebody who is not biased, who has an outside view, will be able to help you always much better. So this is first part, is to get yourself a mentor. And then there is another important part. It says, acquire yourself a friend. Literally, buy yourself a friend. Kne lecha chaver. That's a strange statement. Why does it say, buy yourself a friend? How much do friends cost? I don't even have my wallet on me now. I can't even see how much money I have. Can I afford a friend? I don't know. Maybe I can't afford any friends. What does it mean to buy yourself a friend? Having friends is an ongoing effort. You cannot just expect to have friendships coming your way, or I should say more precisely, you cannot expect the friendships you want to be coming your way. You might end up having a lot of people you're hanging around with. Are these the people you want to be friends with? Very often it's not. And this is why the idea of the Torah is that we are responsible for creating our own surrounding. It is up to me to determine who do I want to have as a friend and who I don't want to have as a friend. And very often, we think that social circles is something where we end up in. The Torah disagrees. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, who has been for a long time the chief rabbi of Great Britain, he has passed away already several years ago. When he was young, he grew up in a Jewish traditional family. But then there was a period in his life where he was not so interested in Jewish life. And he was in his 20s then. He went to Cambridge University to study philosophy, and he was getting his PhD in philosophy from there. And while he was studying there, he had a lot of very complex questions about issues of life. And on his trip to the US, he decided to visit various distinguished thinkers who he would possibly get answers to his questions from. And he was speaking to both Jewish and non-Jewish people about the questions that he had. And then he was also thinking to maybe visit the Lubavitcher Rebbe. He heard that this is a great scholar, a very smart man. Maybe he will be able to answer his questions. Jonathan Sacks is walking down Eastern Parkway at 2 a.m. in the morning. I heard the story from him. He was not saying where he was walking from or where he was walking to, but it was 2 a.m. in the morning on Eastern Parkway, and he realizes that he is somewhere near Crown Heights. And he thinks Crown Heights, that's where the Lubavitcher Rebbe's headquarters, his shul, his synagogue is. Oh, okay. He walks around and he sees this building, 77 Eastern Parkway. He decided to walk in there. He walks in there. He wonders. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. It's empty. And then he sees there's a room with light and the door cracked open. He looks in. He says, I'm looking to see Lubavitcher Rebbe. Do you know where he is? The man sitting in the room says, hello, welcome. That was the Rebbe. They spent over 2 hours talking, and Jonathan Sacks was asking the Rebbe many questions about his philosophical dilemmas. You know, this shul, the synagogue, makes an announcement that we hired a new rabbi now, and our rabbi is not only a rabbi, he's also a doctor. It's a rabbi, Dr. Cohen. So this boy hears this announcement. After the services, runs over to this new rabbi, says, Rabbi, I heard that you're not only a rabbi, also a doctor. He says, yes, my stomach hurts. Could you help me? The rabbi says, well, I'm not a doctor for stomachache. He says, so what kind of doctor are you? He says, I'm doctor of philosophy. Philosophy? What kind of sickness is that? So Jonathan Sacks was asking all of his questions in philosophy. And when he finished, he was about to go. But apparently the Rebbe was not so easy to say goodbye to. The Rebbe said, 1 second, I answered all of your questions. Now, I have some questions for you. He was not ready for that. What are your questions? The Rebbe says, you have a Jewish background. You received Jewish education. There are not many people like you in Cambridge. I want to know, what are you doing for Jewish life in Cambridge? Jonathan Sacks was not doing much for Jewish life in Cambridge. And is it evident he was not interested in doing much for Jewish life in Cambridge? And he, being a polite British boy, started looking for the most correct answer. And he says, Rebbe, please understand, in the situation that I find myself in right now. The Rebbe interrupted him, which, by the way, was very uncharacteristic for the Rebbe in conversations with people. And the Rebbe says, a Jew never finds himself in a situation. A Jew always creates his situation. We very often want to look at ourselves as products of situation, sometimes even as victims of situation. And to a large part, it refers to the friendships that we make, or neighbors we have, or co-workers we have. We create our surroundings, and this is what the Torah is insisting on. And there is a psychologist, Judith Snow, who created this diagram. There are several levels of our connections with people. First is intimacy. This is our immediate family, my nuclear family. Then there's a level of friendships, my close friend. Who are my close friends? Then there are people who are in level of participation. They, I guess you could say, they are my more distant friend. They participate in my life. And then the furthest out circle is exchange. Exchange means people who I deal with just because I have to. My co-worker. Our cubicles are right next to each other, and I will be asking this guy or this lady for a pair of scissors or ruler when I need one. And if I'll have a question about something work-related, I will ask this person, but that's about it. Now, these are the circles that everybody has. But how do we move people from one circle to another? Depends wholly on us. Which means that if I have somebody who is my friendship circle, but you know what? After spending some time with him, I realized maybe I should not be spending so much time with this person. I could move this person to another level of participation. On the other hand, if I have somebody on level of exchange who I really want to get closer to, I can bring them closer. And that's very, very important. And now we will ask ourselves a Talmudic question. Are you all ready for Talmud study? Okay, roll up your sleeve. This story is relayed to us in the Tractate of Shabbat, and most of you probably know the end of the story. But the background is that there was a non-Jewish man that decided to convert to Judaism. But as it appears, this non-Jewish man didn't have much patience for rabbis' sermons. Rabbis take very long to deliver their thoughts. You probably know it just from your interactions with me. So this young man comes to a great rabbi of those times, Shammai, and he says, I want to convert to Judaism. Please teach me the entire Torah. There's only one caveat. Make sure to teach it to me during the period of time that it takes me to stand on my foot. As long as I can stand on my foot, I could listen to you. My attention span is not any longer than that. Shammai, being a great scholar, figured right away there's no way to teach anyone a Torah, a whole Torah, while he's standing on one foot. What did Shammai tell him? Shammai told him to get lost. And lost he did. But then he went to a different rabbi, who also lived in those times, a great Jewish sage as well, Hillel. And when he came to Hillel and asked him to teach the entire Torah while he's standing on one foot, Hillel produced probably the most quoted phrase in the Torah that has been since called the golden rule. Don't do unto others what you don't want to be done to you. And then Hillel answered, and this is the entire Torah, and the rest is just commentary. Now, I probably have to assume that this rabbi made a very important statement, especially we see it from the fact that it's, like I said, probably the most famous part of Talmud, and many people who repeat this golden rule don't even know the origins of the phrase. But having said that, I want to ask you, is this the entire Torah? Is it fair to say that this is the entire Torah? Or at least we could break it up like this. The entire Torah has two parts. We know that Torah has two types of laws. Laws that are pertaining to my connection with other people, how I deal with other people. This is not to cheat, not to steal, not to murder. I hope at least the last one of these everybody keeps here, at least today. And then there's another half of the Torah. There is a large number of commandments that are pertaining to our relationship with God. To eat matzah on Pesach, to fast on Yom Kippur, to light Shabbat candles, to put on tefillin. So probably it would be fair to say that don't do unto others what you don't want to be done to you is encompassing the first half of the Torah that we spoke about. How does it cover the commandment of lighting Shabbat candles or putting on tefillin? It doesn't. So Hillel, being a great rabbi, and then having transcribed this story and this saying in Talmud, obviously was very precise in what he was saying. So how can you say that don't do unto others what you don't want to be done to you is the entire Torah? So, guess what? There are several answers. And one of them is that it says don't do to others. Others include God as well. It doesn't only refer to people. Others is also God. Now, if you would have given someone his whole life and everything what he has and has been taking care of him for many, many years. And then you come to him and he says, but you know what? Could you do me a favor? Could you put on tefillin every day? Could you light Shabbat candles Friday night? Could you not eat crabs? And this guy is looking at you while you are giving him life, while you are giving him everything he has, and eating a crab, a piece of crab. You probably will get upset. So don't do unto others, means to God, what you don't want to be done to you. That's one answer. The second answer, which is given, that actually Hillel meant only half of the Torah. Why? Because this guy didn't convert to Judaism yet. So Hillel wanted to give him only the half that's pertaining to him. A non-Jew is not obligated to keep Shabbat or to keep kosher. So Hillel told him really only half of the Torah. But he said the whole Torah. And if we're going to be looking at the first answer, why didn't Hillel say God? Why did he say just others? So we are going to be answering this question today. Everything what I said before was just introduction. Okay. We are going to be answering this question today. Before we answer this question, we will make a little detour. And we will make a detour exploring a fundamental concept of Hasidut and Kabbalah, which is based on what is written in the Talmud and in Tanakh, that we all have two souls. You know that every one of us has an animalistic soul and a godly soul. And you all know that this dichotomy is what is giving us freedom of choice, because at every moment we are pulled in two different directions. Either I will do what my godly soul wants, or I'll do what my animalistic soul wants. You also probably heard from me and from other rabbis who talk about this issue that an animalistic soul is not bad. Many theologies, many religions, and many ideologies look at this world as a war between good and bad, as a struggle between the positive and the negative. An animalistic and godly soul is not that. Godly soul is good because it's godly, but an animalistic soul is allowing us to do a lot of good things, even a lot of heroic things. If somebody saves someone's life because he wants to become famous, he is driven by purely animalistic desires. He wants to become famous. But he's saving someone's life. He's doing a great mitzvah. So our animalistic soul can push us to do mitzvahs. So then, why do we need godly soul if our animalistic soul can push us to do mitzvahs as well? What is the answer? Our animalistic soul is capable of everything besides for one detail. Our animalistic soul cannot be selfless. It cannot be altruistic. So now, having said that, we will now look at a Hasidic story, Hasidic saying, that seems like those ancient Hasidic rabbis did not know math very well. There's an old Hasidic saying that if you are experiencing a spiritual difficulty, what you need to do is go consult with a friend. Why? For one simple reason. Because you have a godly soul and your friend has a godly soul, and the two godly souls of you gonna be attacking one animalistic soul of you, so it's gonna be two against one, you'll win. Sounds great, but I have a mathematical problem. Each person in this picture has two souls, a godly soul and an animalistic soul. So when two of them come together, how many souls do we have? Four. So it's not two against one. It's two against two. Those Hasidic rabbis don't know math. No, they did know math. What is the answer? The answer is that a godly soul is altruistic, and that's why it can genuinely, truly unite itself with another godly soul. An animalistic soul is selfish. It only has self-interest. It will never fully unite with another animalistic soul. It can't. It has its own self-interest in mind all the time. So now we understand the differences between our godly soul and between our animalistic soul. And now we also understand something about our connection with other people. When we connect with others, we could connect based on our animalistic soul, and we can connect based on our godly soul. Now, unless you are a completely righteous person, you will always have both souls in play during your day. You cannot completely eliminate one of these souls, unless you're a completely wicked person or a completely righteous person. I suspect that neither one of us here in this room are neither one of these two categories. So, we always have these two souls which are pulling us in different directions. And sometimes we act on our godly soul, sometimes we act on our animalistic soul. Sometimes our connection with someone next to us is based on one of them, and sometimes it's based on the other one. And this is the difference between a true, genuine connection and a selfish connection. So now, if we'll go back to those circles of our relationships with others, it will also become clear whenever I am communicating with a coworker who is there in my life just because he happened to be next to me and I have no interest in being really close to him, and all interactions I have with him are just about business, these interactions are based on my animalistic soul. And there's nothing wrong with that. We have animalistic souls, and our animalistic souls are capable of very good things also, like we said before. I go to work, you know why? Because I want to make money. And I need to do my work good and fairly because I need to make this money. And if this coworker is helping me to do that, or I'm helping him to do that, that's great. So now you understand that this is the outer circle. Our intimate circle, the most inner circle. I really hope that at least most of the time, my interactions with my most intimate circle are based on my godly soul. Again, will it be all the time? No, it will not be 100% of the time. But the more it will be based on that, the deeper this connection will be. There's an example, which is a wrong example, but it's a very good example. When people speak about true love for someone else, they often refer to an example of how a parent loves his or her children. Now, I've got news for you. It's a wrong example. Why? A parent usually views his or her child as an extension of themselves. This is why Talmud says you should never praise a professional in a certain field in front of a professional in this field if you're praising him too much. If I know a great musician and I come to my friend who is a musician and I'm telling him how good this musician is, how good this other person is, Talmud says it's not very ethical. Why? Because you might invoke some envy, some jealousy from this musician. There's one exception. If the other musician I'm talking about is the child of this musician. Because no parent will ever be envious of their children, no matter how great they are and how not good the parent is. Why? Because if I am looking at my child, I'm looking at him or her as an extension of myself. So that's why when I say that I love my children, really, it's love which is self-focused. I love them because I love myself. But at the same time, even though it's a wrong example, it's a very good example. It's an example of how you could love someone else just like you love yourself. How you could love yourself because they're part of you? This is precisely the example of love which is based on my godly soul. When I love someone, and this love is coming from my godly soul, I love them like I love myself. This is why it says in the Torah, Ve'ahavta l'recha kamocha, love your fellow like yourself. And I'm capable of loving my fellow like myself only if this love is based on my godly soul. So now I understand that if I have a circle of my close friends or I have a circle of my acquaintances, I can always track every interaction I have with them. Do I think it's based on my godly soul and it's selfless, or do I think it's based on my animalistic self and it's selfish? Now, again, you will never be able to eliminate your animalistic soul. So don't be upset if you notice that your interactions are based on animalistic soul sometimes. That's fine. But at least keep it in mind. Pay attention to it. And the more often you will have interactions which are coming from your godly soul, the deeper your relationships will be. And now we will also see how very often people confuse this with even such a simple things as love. We often use the word love. I love you. I love my house. I love this area. I love ice cream. We use the word love very often, very loosely. But there are very different kinds of love. There's a love that comes from my godly soul. And there's a love that comes from my animalistic soul. We're going to see this in this video that I'm about to show you.
There is a Jewish folktale that illustrates how vague the meaning of the word love can be, and also demonstrates some of the basic problems in statements such as, "I love you." Once upon a time, a fisherman caught a large pike, and when he pulled the fish out of the water and saw its size, he said, "This is wonderful! I'll take it to the Baron. He loves pike." The poor fish says to himself, "There's some hope for me yet." The fisherman brings the fish to the manor house, and the guard says, "What do you have?" "A pike." "Great," says the guard. "The Baron loves pike." The fish feels that there is some corroboration of the facts. The fisherman enters the palace, and though the fish can hardly breathe, he still has hope. The Baron loves pike. He is brought into the kitchen, and all the cooks exclaim how much the Baron loves pike. The fish is placed on a table, and the Baron himself enters and gives instructions. "Cut off the tail, cut off the head, and slit it this way." With his last breath, the fish cries out in great despair, "Why did you lie? You don't love pike, you love yourself."
So, this is about love. When we say we love something, what does it really mean? Do I really love something? If I say I love Pavarotti, do I really love Pavarotti? No, I don't love Pavarotti. I love what Pavarotti does to me. Pavarotti himself, I couldn't care less about the guy. So when I say I love this and this guy, I love this and this person, what does it really mean that I love them? And unfortunately, too often, when we say we love somebody, really, it's not about them, it's about us. And this is exactly what Kabbalah is trying to explain about love. I can love someone else because I love them, and I can love someone else because I love myself. And here is a very important thing. In the Western world, very often, people are told, be yourself. Be your true self. Like the famous classic song, I did it my way, right? I did everything my way. Be yourself. Torah doesn't say be yourself. The Torah says be your best self. Myself has two parts. I can be myself like an animal, and I can be myself like a godly being. Both of them are myself. I need to choose which myself I'm being. My animalistic self is selfish and doesn't allow me any genuine connection with other people. And my best self is allowing me to create genuine connections with other people. And I often tell people that, do you know what is the greatest thing we humans are capable of? People often think that the greatest achievement of a human is the ability to think, ability to influence others, ability that shows some form of greatness. I often say that the greatest ability that we have is the ability of self-abnegation, ability of forgetting about yourself, ability of not thinking about yourself. That's our greatest ability. And that's what is allowing us to transcend ourselves. So now we have the answer to the question that we had about the statement of Hillel, the golden rule. When Hillel says, don't do unto others what you don't want to be done to you, what does it mean? It means that if you can care about others like you care about yourself, if you can see others as the continuation of your own self, if others in your mind are like you, then you're living your life driven by your godly soul. Hillel said, the entire Torah, do you know what is the testing of the entire Torah? The test of the entire Torah is whether you can look at another person as a part of you. This is the test of the entire Torah. And the rest is just commentary. The rest tells you how to do it. Why? Because in order to look at another person as a part of me, I need to put in tefillin, light Shabbat candles. I need to keep Shabbos and to keep kosher. Hillel's motto is relate to others like you relate to yourself. And this is the entire Torah. And now we understand something very important. Our relationship with other people is always an ongoing journey. Like it says, acquire yourself a friend, buy yourself a friend. It's a constant investment. Your friendship that I have is not something that I just can take for granted. And by the way, do you know what I hear is the reason for most of fights between close friends? As a rabbi, I often hear people come to me when they have something, God forbid, negative happening in their lives. And very often people come to me when they are getting into fight with their close friends or close relatives for that matter. And I hear these stories time after time. Do you know what is the most common reason why people say they get in a fight with their friends or with their family members? Because these people are starting to take their relationship for granted. And by the way, do you know why we always get in fights with our relatives more often than with our friends? Brother and sister, while they live under one roof. Brother and brother, sister and sister, always fight more than they fight with their close friends. You know why? Because they all know that my friend will walk away from me if I will say this and this and this. My brother, he'll always be my brother. My sister, she'll always be my sister. We start taking this relationship for granted, and that's when it goes sour. So that's why it says, "Knelecha chaver," acquire yourself a friend. It's an ongoing journey. And I always have to recognize that sometimes my actions and my words are driven by my godly soul. Sometimes they're driven by my animalistic soul. And I need to gauge and try to make it more often about godly soul and less often about animalistic soul. And here we come to a very important word, empathy. What is empathy? What is the difference between empathy and sympathy? We're going to watch a video now that's going to explain to us what is really empathy, and then we're going to see how our godly soul is helping us with exactly that.
Brené Brown is an American professor and social worker, a best-selling author, and a podcast host. In a relatable and engaging style, she clarifies the distinction between sympathy and empathy and illustrates the idea of an empathetic person putting themselves in the same emotional space as someone who is suffering.
So what is empathy? And why is it very different than sympathy? Empathy fuels connection. Sympathy drives disconnection. Empathy, it's very interesting. Teresa Wiseman is a nursing scholar who studied professions, very diverse professions, where empathy is relevant, and came up with four qualities of empathy. Perspective taking, the ability to take the perspective of another person or recognize their perspective as their truth. Staying out of judgment. Not easy when you enjoy it as much as most of us do. Recognizing emotion in other people and then communicating that. Empathy is feeling with people. And to me, I always think of empathy as this kind of sacred space when someone's kind of in a deep hole and they shout out from the bottom and they say, I'm stuck, it's dark, I'm overwhelmed. And then we look and we say, hey, you can climb down. I know what it's like down here, and you're not alone. Sympathy is, ooh, it's bad, uh-huh. No, you want a sandwich? Empathy is a choice, and it's a vulnerable choice, because in order to connect with you, I have to connect with something in myself that knows that feeling. Rarely, if ever, does an empathic response begin with at least. And we do it all the time. Because you know what? Someone just shared something with us that's incredibly painful, and we're trying to silver lining it. I don't think that's a verb, but I'm using it as one. We're trying to put the silver lining around it. So, I had a miscarriage. Oh, at least you know you can get pregnant. I think my marriage is falling apart. At least you have a marriage. John's getting kicked out of school. At least Sarah is an A student. But one of the things we do sometimes in the face of very difficult conversations is we try to make things better. If I share something with you that's very difficult, I'd rather you say, I don't even know what to say right now. I'm just so glad you told me. Because the truth is, rarely can a response make something better. What makes something better is connection.
So what do we see here? We see that this lady obviously is not saying it from the Jewish perspective, and she does not know the terminology of godly soul and animalistic soul. But she says that the true way of connecting with someone, a true way of connecting with someone is experiencing their feeling. In other words, not feeling yourself, but feeling them. And as a matter of fact, there is two types of empathy that have been outlined in modern psychology. There's something which is called cognitive empathy. Cognitive empathy means understanding the person's feeling. somebody was called a bad name and he's upset. Well, you are thinking, if I would be called that name, I would also be upset. I understand why he's upset. That's pretty fair way of looking at things. That's great if you can understand why a person is experiencing the emotion that he's experiencing right now. That's great. But that's only cognitive empathy, because it only allows you to understand what you're experiencing in his place. But then there's also something which is called emotional empathy or affective empathy. What is an affective empathy? Not understanding why he is feeling this way and bouncing off your memory of feeling this way when something similar happened. Feeling right now like this person is feeling. We brought an example of a parent and a child before, and again, I'm going back to this example because it is probably the best of way of describing one person feeling that another person is a part of him. A little boy is coming home and he is ecstatic because his teacher praised him. He's very happy. Now, is the mother that hears this from this boy says, yeah, I remember when I was 6 years old, I was also very happy when my teacher said that I did a good job. Yeah, I understand why he's so happy. No, that's not how the mother usually thinks. If the child is happy, the mother is happy together with him. The child is jumping from joy. She is also jumping from joy. She is experiencing his emotion. So when a friend of mine comes to me complaining about something that happened to him, I can say, well, yeah, I can imagine if something like this would happen to me, I'll be feeling the same way. Yeah, that's great. That's the first step. But then I could feel the same thing what he's feeling. That's called affective or emotional empathy. And this is possible only when you are operating based on your godly soul. Why? Because the first type of empathy is mirroring someone else's emotions of my own. I am in the picture here. It's me. The second type of empathy is not about me. It's not me. I forgot about myself. I'm experiencing what this person is experiencing. And this is why the second type of empathy is our true connection with others. And again, going back to those circles, we can understand that people in our intimate circle, our immediate family, it's very important to have emotional empathy, affective empathy in my relationship with them. People who are in the most outer circle, my coworkers, with them, I can have intellectual empathy, cognitive empathy. Yeah, this guy, his boss yelled at him. He's upset. I understand. I would be upset also if my boss would have yelled at me. Okay, yeah, that's bad. And then I could do like this horse from the cartoon. No, thanks. These are the two types of empathy and two types of relationships. And this is the most important takeaway from today's class. How we can relate to our friends and to other people. What you're asking is, do you always have to be empathetic with other people? No. If somebody is attacking you, if somebody is saying something to hurt you, empathy is my way of connecting with others. You don't have to connect with everyone. Now, I will tell you, if someone is saying something hurtful to me, and I will at least understand where he's coming from, why he's so angry, and I will be able to relate to the reason why he is saying what he's saying to me, it might actually help me and might help my situation. Very often, as I notice, and I'm sure you've experienced the same, when somebody is upset at you, if somebody says something not nice to you, that's not about you at all. The guy is going through very big problems in his business. The lady is experiencing difficulties with her children. This guy is going through difficult family times. This lady is not doing well with her health. And they are, because of that, on the edge today. And your little something was a trigger that set them off. So it's not about you. So the Torah doesn't say that I must be empathetic with everyone 100% of the time. I don't think it's even possible, and I don't even think it's recommended. I don't want to empathize with some people at all. But at the same time, in a specific situation that you described, again, there are many different scenarios, but it's possible that empathy on your part will help you deal with the situation. Forget about the other guy. I'm not even talking what we're going to do with him, to him, or whether he's a good person or a bad person. If somebody is saying something that is hurtful to you, if you understand that it's actually not about you, or maybe very often, maybe the guy is not going through any difficult times in his life at all. His life is perfect. But you said something little, which was, in your eyes, completely benign, and it made him crazy. It set him off. He's angry. He lost his control. Why? Maybe you happen to know from his history that triggered his memories from 30 years ago when something happened and somebody told him something similar that sounded like what you just said. So again, it's not about you. We're going to watch a video now.
Lesson 1. The Art of Empathy. 1. At times, we are tempted to attribute relationship success to something beyond our control. However, the Mishnah directs us to acquire a friend, implying that meaningful relationships do not simply happen to us. We can and must make them happen. 2. We each have two souls within ourselves. Our self-oriented soul is naturally apathetic to others, while our godly soul naturally desires to connect with others, sensing itself and others as part of a larger whole. 3. The apathetic animal soul has a firmer grip on the average person's consciousness. Engaging in relationships and friendships requires transcending the animal self, allowing the godly soul to shine. 4. To be in a genuine relationship with another implies being in touch with the divine soul. As such, human connection is not a mere physical or emotional need, but an authentic spiritual experience. 5. The factors that led us into a relationship are not critical. It is common for relationships to begin with self-interest in mind. What is critical is to grow and advance past a self-serving mindset. 6. Cognitive and emotional empathy are crucial for our relationships. Cognitive empathy is the ability to recognize and understand another person's emotions and to communicate this with the other. Effective empathy is experiencing a matching or corresponding emotional reaction to the emotions of another individual. 7. It can be challenging to unleash empathy consistently, especially when preoccupied. The more in tune we are with our godly soul, the easier time we will have in connecting through empathy.